This is Craig Brown, and welcome to Passages. Passages is a space to explore Bible passages used for preaching, reflection, and prayer. My hope is that Passages will shine a unique light on text used for preaching at the First Free Methodist Church of Seattle, or for anyone looking to dive deeper into the Bible. Today's passage is from the book of Hebrews, beginning at chapter 5, verse 11 through verse 14. It's the basis for the sermon at First Free Methodist Church on April 21, 2024. It's the third message in our series called The Art of Holy Living and How We Discover the Grace of God in Everyday Experiences. Let's begin by hearing the text from Hebrews chapter 5 at verse 11. I'll be reading from the New American Standard Bible, its 2020 revision. Concerning him, we have much to say, and it is difficult to explain since you have become poor listeners. For though by this time you ought to be teachers, you have need again for someone to teach you the elementary principles of the actual words of God, and you have come to need milk and not solid food. For everyone who partakes only of milk is unacquainted with the word of righteousness, for he is an infant. But solid food is for the mature, who because of practice have their senses trained to distinguish between good and evil. Well, let's begin with the first couple of verses here, verses 11 and 12. I want to focus first on the condition of the Hebrews. Now, the book of Hebrews is a book we don't read all that often in the life of the church. We don't hear many sermons from it, but it is a rich book, and it was probably written sometime near the very end or even after the Apostle Paul's ministry. Now, the tradition of the church ascribes the writing of the book of Hebrews to Paul, but nearly all scholars do not agree with that. There are elements of Paul's theology throughout the text, but the grammar and the writing style are completely different than what Paul uses. Many scholars believe that it was written by maybe a student of Paul or someone familiar with him. What we do know about Hebrews is what we don't know. It never says in the book of Hebrews who the author is. No one takes so-called credit for it. The book is not clear not only about who wrote it, but it's not even clear about to whom it was addressed. You know, if you pick up one of Paul's other letters, like the letter to the Galatians or the letter to Timothy, inherent when we name that book is who it's addressed to, the letter to the Galatians, the letter to Timothy. Here, it's not really addressed to anyone. If you open up the beginning of the book, you would not find any kind of regular greeting to whom it's addressed, any kinds of greetings at the front end of what is written. It just launches right into the topic that the book wants to discuss. So in some ways, this book lacks kind of all the common forms of a letter. And because of that, it's a little bit more like a sermon or a collection of sermons. From the text itself, though, we can make a couple of, well, I would even say arguable conclusions. One, it's written by a learned theological person or a community. So the influence of Paul is all throughout the text. But as I mentioned, the grammatical style and the vocabulary are completely different than Paul's other writings. Number two, it's written to a Jewish community of Christians because the book is replete with references to Jewish scripture, replete with all sorts of ideas and rabbinic arguments about the nature of Jesus Christ as the expression of Judaism in its fullness. Third, it's written to persuade Jews in whatever community this was from abandoning their newfound Christian expression. Now, that takes us to number four. The cause behind this abandonment of Christian truth is Christian persecution that was probably localized in some way. It may not have been across a broad region or area, but maybe a very localized one. So what was happening in this community is that there were quite a few people of the Jewish faith and tradition who had come to a point in their life where they believed that Jesus was Messiah and had become part of the Christian community. But as persecution began to start against the Christian community, both Jewish and Gentile, Many within the Jewish community sought to find refuge by forsaking their new Christian faith and instead relying on the foundation only of Judaism. So I hate to talk about it in terms of converting from Jewish to Christian and Christian to Jewish. That line isn't very thick in the first century. Suffice to say, these were Jews who had accepted Jesus as Messiah, and because of Christian persecution, they were reflecting and even in some ways acting upon the need to move away from being followers of Jesus and simply holding on to the Jewish faith that they had all along. So when we open up Hebrews chapter 5, we embark on a section that's getting ready to describe the supremacy and the significance of Christ. And in some ways, the writer actually already starts doing this at the beginning of chapter 5, gets to a part where he's trying to describe Jesus as a priest of the order of Melchizedek, and then stops himself. And it's there that we find this section in chapter 5, verses 11 to 14, where the writer is basically saying, this is important stuff about Jesus according as a priest according to the order of Melchizedek, but I'm not sure you're going to get it. And so he frames it in verse 11 by saying this, concerning him, we have much to say, him being Jesus. So the writer's saying there's all sorts of things that we need to talk about Jesus. There's a whole lot to say. And this is a common Greek idiom. There is much to say. In other words, the topic is complex. It has a lot of nuance to it. There's a number of different truths within the teaching. But he's preparing to tell them that it's not something they're perhaps ready to hear. He goes on in that same verse and says, this stuff is difficult to explain. And if you've read through Hebrews chapter 5, 6, and 7, even leaning into chapter 8, there is some difficulty in it, not in terms of it being confusing, but it simply being complex. It requires a level of dedication to follow what the writer's talking about. Not many people have even heard of Melchizedek as a priestly order, but yet the writer makes a lot of hay about Jesus as a priest according to Melchizedek in the chapters that follow. This, again, is another common Greek idiom. It's difficult to explain. Not that the idiom's difficult to explain, but that phrasing, it is difficult to explain, is used oftentimes by Stoic philosophers within Greek culture to help frame for people that what they're going to talk about is difficult to understand, and it's even difficult to explain. It's complex. It's going to require effort. But then the writer in verse 11 says this to them, you have become poor listeners. So the writer says, I've got a lot I want to talk about. It's difficult to explain, but the problem here is you've become poor listeners. Now, that phrasing poor listeners, it literally says in Greek that you're sluggish in understanding or you're hard of hearing, that there's a way in which that this complexity is not going to sink in. What I want you to notice here is the tense of the verb, you have become poor listeners. It's in what's called the perfect tense. It's action that is complete. In other words, action that's perfected. But what it does seem to indicate is that they once were good listeners. Notice how it's phrased here. You have become poor listeners. So at least the writer is acknowledging there's a point at which they were good listeners and now they're poor listeners. So here, again, it's not about a lack of knowledge. It's about a spiritual state of being. The writer goes on in verse 13 and says, well, by now you should be teachers. And this is an acknowledgement after a duration of time, there's not been a progression. Rather, what we're hearing from the writer is that this community has not just progressed, but they've actually regressed. They're not moving forward. They've actually gone backwards. And so now they need again. Notice the word again. It's important because he's reflecting on an experience that they should have had in the past, which they did. Now, in some ways, they need to repeat it. They need again for someone to teach you the actual words of God. Now, what words? So when we read it, we might automatically lurch to Scripture as saying, well, those are the words of God. But step back for a minute. Words could have all sorts of meaning. This could be the Old Testament, certainly, in light of Jesus. This could be the words of God as Jesus' own teaching in words. It could be the gospel narrative. We're not quite sure what the writer is saying here, is that they need to be taught the actual words of God, but there's something fundamental that they have missed or that they have forgotten that needs to be reestablished. And it'll become very clear by verse 14 what that is. And I'll give you the hint. It's about the moral and ethical theology of being a public witness. This is what they've stepped away from, and we're going to talk about why that is in a moment. So then the writer introduces this contrast between babies needing milk versus solid food. Again, this is another common Greek idiom. This is not used in the Jewish world. This is used in the Greek-speaking world, that when things need to be watered down or simplified or made easy for people, that's referred to as giving them milk versus something more complex and mature and significant. That's like solid food. So it's an argument between simplicity and complexity. What this text is commonly used for in our day is for encouraging people to study the Bible more or to know more about God. And certainly that's always a good thing. But there's more here than that. Remember, this has to do with something that they lost, that they once were a different way than they are now. They have become hard of hearing, or they have become unable to process what's going on. So it's not that they knew something and they It's not that they never knew something. It's that they knew something and they lost it. So I would argue, when it's talking about this thing between milk and solid food, it's not so much about knowledge of the Bible or a knowledge of theology. The writer is using a little bit of irony here, a little bit of reverse psychology, if you will. In other words, the writer's saying, I have so many things I want to tell you about Jesus. I have so much I want you to know, but gosh, I just don't think you can hear it. I'm just not sure you're there. And so it's designed to motivate this community to lean in, to stretch themselves, and to return perhaps to a state in which they once found themselves. And that opens up a key passageway for us here, that the Christian life is one devoted to progression and deepening faith. You know, the writer here describes a community that once had maturity, but has now lost it. The work of following Jesus is an ongoing work. As I shared with my congregation on Easter Sunday, it's not like a switch. You don't turn it on or turn it off. It's an ongoing work. It's a way in which we have to step in each day into a deeper commitment to following Jesus. And the concern for us is oftentimes in doing this, we focus too much on the product of our life rather than the process of it, especially when it comes to spiritual things. And what this text is trying to help us understand is that there's a progression to be had here. There's a movement, and that we need to be much more focused on the process of our spiritual life and growth and maturity rather than the product of it. When our focus is on the product, certain habits, certain behaviors, certain words, certain thoughts, we always then sometimes like to point to what we did or the accomplishments that we've had. And this text is helping us understand that the focus isn't on the goals we've achieved, it's on the progression and the movement we've made. So part of this key passageway of how the Christian life is devoted to progression and deepening faith is this, is that what will disturb us when we're reading this text is that the writer's not talking about the amassing of truth, knowledge, and facts. The writer here is speaking of something far more risky and public, that Christian maturity is about more than just our internals or the internal knowledge or insight we have. If it doesn't find expression outside of ourselves, then there's something we've perhaps missed or something that we've even lost. Now the writer turns to these next two verses where there's a contrast for the witness in the world of the church and of this particular community. So here's the contrast that explains the problem faced by the people who actually read the book of Hebrews for the first time. There's a contrast here between milk and solid food. That metaphor is returning. Milk for infant, solid food for the mature. Well, what do they mean? Well, milk, in this case, in verse 13, is the writer says that they're unacquainted with the word of righteousness. Now, this is a kind of a puzzling little phrase because it's the only place in the New Testament where this phrase is used, word of righteousness. Now remember, in Greek, the word for righteousness, Greek being the language the New Testament is written in, the word for righteousness is dikaiosune, and it refers to right living, but it also refers to just living. Remember, the word for righteousness that we often always translate as righteousness in Greek is the same word for justice. Justice and righteousness are the same word. They're not separated. They're together. So the word for righteousness here, it refers to something that's external, not internal. The word for righteousness is about that which is coming out of us or that which is manifest. It has to do with the goodness or the kindness, the ways in which we express ourselves. So the word of righteousness here is about how right and just living is formed and expressed. That they don't, the writer's saying, you're not acquainted with the word of righteousness anymore. So imagine a community like this that is in being persecuted for their Christian faith. They're living in fear. So it becomes easier to abandon the public-facing expressions of that faith. This is a community that's trying to hide. They're internalizing. They're focused on themselves and their own survival. They see that being Christian is a risk. And so what they're doing is they're taking away the public expressions of their Christian faith so that they are not as noticeable any longer. So all the ethical and moral imperatives of the gospel are being left on the table because they don't want to be identified. Now, the only other time we hear this phrase, word of righteousness, used even in Christian literature after the book of Hebrews is less than 100 years later. And it's used in the writings of St. Polycarp, who was a disciple of Paul by two generations. So Polycarp's teacher was one of Paul's disciples, if you can follow that along. So he's like, Polycarp is like Paul's spiritual grandson, if you will. And Polycarp uses the same phrase because he said that people had forsaken the word of righteousness as a way in which he would describe how they tried to avoid persecution and martyrdom. So it helps us understand that they're unacquainted with the word of righteousness and that they've stepped away from the public-facing way in which they're called to live out their faith. I'd also encourage you to take note in verse 13 that the word infant there is in the singular, not the plural. So they need milk like an infant, a single infant, not like it doesn't say milk like infants, plural, it's singular. And this is just kind of a little nuance talking about how this state of being in which the hearers of the book of Hebrews found themselves were very individualized and out for their own good and seeking to find ways to take shelter from the age in which they live. They had turned inward, even to what I'll talk about in the sermon on this Sunday, to the point of being navel-gazing. But that's contrasted with solid food. Now, the solid food is different. It's in verse 14. Now, this solid food, it says, because of practice, have their senses trained to distinguish between good and evil. See, that's the moral and ethical theology sitting there, that you're able to distinguish between good and evil. So what does it mean to be on solid food? Well, now we know. It's to have your senses trained. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean your five senses per se, but it is more about attenuating yourself spiritually to be able to distinguish between good and evil. Now, good and evil are public-facing things. Distinguishing between good and evil have to do with moral and ethical terms. They're not statements of being. They're actually acts that are good and acts that are evil. So when they sense good, they should align to it. And when they sense evil, they should name it and avoid it. So solid food is not good is better than evil. It's really the capacity to distinguish between good and evil. This is a public-facing skill. It's open. What do Christians practice and what do they not practice? What do they hold on to that is good, and what do they hold on to, what do they let go of that is evil? So this is a public act. And I want you to notice in verse 14, when it talks about those who are mature, that is in the plural. Remember, infant was singular. Adults, or the mature in verse 14, are plural. It's a community. It's a group of people working together. That opens a key passageway for us, and that is this, that Christian maturity is prophetic and it is public-facing. Now, the community of people to whom the book of Hebrews was written had reason to fear from persecution. And so they moved away from their public expressions of goodness and righteousness. They were hiding, and fear had become their master, and thus their role of being the public presence of God's love has been eroded. And they're no longer salt and light in the world. They have retreated inward. And we have some of the same lessons we need to learn. How do we hold the balance of being moral and ethical while not doing harm or appearing as holier than thou? The reality is, for the Christian community, our work is public-facing and it is not private. So being able to point to the good of our world is important, and being able to point to the evil of our day is also important. So even in our context, in the United States, for example, where there's little or no persecution, I would even argue that Christianity still enjoys positions of privilege and power in some places. Even in that setting, we're oftentimes still afraid to manifest our discernment or our ability to understand good and evil. So the question we might sit with is this, is where are we called to be more expressive of our truth? That doesn't mean to be dogmatic, but where are we called to be more expressive? And how do we do that with grace and with love? Well, if you have comments or reflections, I invite you to visit my website, revcraig.com, and you can click on News in the upper right-hand corner, and then on the drop-down menu, you'll see Podcasts appear. Click on that, and then click on an episode and leave a comment. When you do leave a comment, it generates an email that I receive that there's been a comment posted, so I go to my website and I respond to your comments there. So if you make a comment and are expecting an email response from me, you won't receive it. You'll need to look at the comment thread on a particular episode to see my responses to your questions and comments, which I always appreciate and I'm glad to receive. I'd also encourage you to visit our website, ffmc.org, firstfreemethodistchurch.org. So you can learn more about Free Methodism and how you can connect with our community. For now, I bid you all grace. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.